Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Multiple Myeloma. And there has been significant progress in the treatment of multiple myeloma, and you're going to hear about that in today's program. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and 24 other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and because of all of you that we've been able to reach so many of you. We have on the call today over 905 participants on the call, so there are so many of you on this call today. It's a very large call, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and states, and we also have international participants from lots of different countries. I'm just going to name them: from Algeria, Australia, the Bahamas, Brazil, Canada, India, Jamaica, Korea, Pakistan, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you have chosen to spend the next hour with us. I would like to turn your attention to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about the topics our speakers will be covering, and there is also information about all of the different collaborating organizations, their websites and 800 numbers, as additional resources for each of you as you navigate your experience with living with multiple myeloma. There also is a wonderful informational sheet called Door to Door, which is an information about a Cancer Care's Multiple Myeloma Transportation Assistance Program, and you'll hear more about that during the program. So there's lots of resources in your materials. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to complete that evaluation form at the end of today's program. Your feedback is so critically important to us as we develop programs. Indeed, today's program was based on your requests that we do a program and do programs on multiple myeloma and their progress in treatment. So please tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to implement your suggestions. Thank you. And today's program was made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Novartis Oncology. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Nupur Rajay, Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. She's also Director, Center for Multiple Myeloma, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Rajay is going to cover an overview of multiple myeloma. She's going to talk about the current standard of care, new treatment approaches and clinical trials, reducing complications from bone disease, and quality of life concerns. Dr. Rajay?
Thank you, Carolyn. It is a pleasure to be here today. Each year, as you all know, about 20,000 people are diagnosed with multiple myeloma. This is a cancer of the bone marrow. Bone marrow contains cells called plasma cells, which are white blood cells, which are important to the immune system. Normally, plasma cells make up less than 5% of this bone marrow. And for reasons not completely understood to all of us, sometimes these plasma cells can grow out of control, and that's when they're referred to as myeloma cells. These myeloma cells can fill up the marrow space and cause damage to the bone. And over time, they can collect to form little tumors in different bones, which is where the name multiple comes from. In the early stages of diagnosis, myeloma sometimes can be fairly asymptomatic. In fact, about 20% of patients who present with myeloma will be diagnosed with myeloma for some unrelated workup for a health-related issue outside of myeloma. But as myeloma progresses, patients with myeloma do become symptomatic. The symptoms which are commonly experienced by patients with myeloma include symptoms related to bone disease. This bone disease occurs largely because of the myeloma cells occupying the different bone marrow spaces, and in addition, also working with cells called osteoclasts, which typically destroy bones. Most patients will present with pain or with weakness and fractures, and this is because of destruction of these bones with either the myeloma cells or these osteoclasts. Drugs like bisphosphonates should be used in this situation, which helps strengthen the bones and help prevent problems such as fractures. Other symptoms which are commonly seen in patients with multiple myeloma include tiredness or fatigue, and this largely occurs from decrease in their blood counts, such as anemia. As I'd mentioned earlier on, myeloma cells typically live in the bone marrow, and when you have an excess of these myeloma cells in the bone marrow, some of the normal cells which live within that bone marrow are crowded out, such as the red blood cells. This is when patients become anemic, and this anemia can lead to tiredness. Another problem often seen in patients with myeloma includes kidney problems. Kidney problems can occur because of damage from excess amounts of proteins, which are typically produced by myeloma cells or the tumor cells. Another reason to have kidney problems in myeloma patients is because of high blood calcium levels, and this can occur, as I previously mentioned, because of the bone destruction from these myeloma cells. Drinking lots of fluids, plenty of water, is critical and helps keep kidneys well flushed and keeps the kidney function intact. As I'd mentioned earlier on, these plasma cells or myeloma cells are immune cells, and when they are not working properly, the immune system of myeloma patients tends to be affected and compromised. This is why myeloma patients are a little more prone to infections, specifically pneumonias, so that if you end up with an infection, it is prudent to start treating that infection promptly and aggressively with antibiotics. Patients are often diagnosed with multiple myeloma with different tests which are performed by their treating physicians. A common test performed is the bone marrow biopsy. A bone marrow biopsy, if it shows an increase in the plasma cells of more than 10%, is diagnostic of multiple myeloma. We also do other special tests on these bone marrow biopsies, but that doesn't necessarily dictate how one is treated for their myeloma. Additionally, one should be doing other tests such as X-rays or a skeletal survey or a bone survey. And what a bone survey or a skeletal survey will pick up is the bone disease I talked to you earlier about, so that it is able to pick up weakened bone, fractured bones. There are certain situations where patients need more than just X-rays, and these include MRIs or magnetic resonance imaging, and sometimes we also resort to imaging such as PET CT scans. Other blood tests should be done by your doctors, which include tests to assess kidney function, tests to assess anemia, calcium levels, and your liver function tests. A very important test, which is typically done in myeloma patients, is to look for the protein which is produced by myeloma cells. This is seen in about 90% of myeloma patients. The protein can be detected both in the blood as well as in the urine, which is what needs to be tested when people are being diagnosed with myeloma. As I've mentioned earlier, there's about 20% of patients with myeloma who are diagnosed with myeloma but will not necessarily have the symptoms of myeloma. And those patients don't really need treatment, and they will be followed by their treating physicians and watched for the development of symptoms. However, as myeloma progresses, one does need to get treated for myeloma. As Carolyn had mentioned earlier on, we are very fortunate because we have a number of new and effective treatments for the treatment of myeloma now. Things have evolved over the last 10 and 15 years. We have several drugs which are FDA approved for the treatment of myeloma, and these not only help control your myeloma in more than 90% of people, but because the responses to these are so encouraging, we are actually seeing complete remission or complete control of myeloma in nearly half the patients who are being treated today. Some of the drugs which we've been using in the last 10 years now include a certain class of drugs which is referred to as immunomodulator drugs. The first immunomodulator drug which was used in the treatment for myeloma was called thalidomide. It was used now more than 15 years back, and initially it was used in advanced multiple myeloma. But because it was so effective in treatment of advanced myeloma, it was then used in the treatment of newly diagnosed patients in combination with a steroid called dexamethasone. The combination of thalidomide and dexamethasone has shown very nice responses in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients and, in fact, is an approved line of treatment for taking care of patients with myeloma. Because of its effectiveness, we've now started incorporating drugs like thalidomide with other older drugs so that patients who are older and not necessarily transplant candidates are also being treated with thalidomide, but in combination with drugs like melphalan or Alkaran and prednisone. We're also fortunate now to have a newer, much more potent immunomodulator drug, and this is called either lenalidomide or Revlimid. This was first used again in advanced myeloma, and because it was noted to be very effective in people with relapsed and refractory multiple myeloma, we started using Revlimid or lenalidomide in the treatment of patients with newly diagnosed myeloma. Like thalidomide, lenalidomide is used in combination with dexamethasone for the treatment of myeloma. There's another class of drugs which is very effective in the treatment of myeloma, and this class of drug is referred to as proteasome inhibitors. And bortezomib is one of the first in its new class of drugs called these proteasome inhibitors. Again, like thalidomide and lenalidomide, bortezomib was first used in advanced disease and now, in fact, is used in newly diagnosed patients with multiple myeloma. We've gotten to a point where now we are combining both proteasome inhibitors and IMiDs, and we're seeing nearly 100% response rates in our patients with myeloma. Stem cell transplantation is certainly an option for treatment of multiple myeloma patients. Many factors need to be considered to determine whether a patient is a good candidate for a stem cell transplant or not. When a patient receives his own stem cells, the procedure is called an autologous stem cell transplant. For some patients, in fact, in myeloma, we do two autologous transplants within a six-month period, and this is referred to as tandem transplants. When a patient gets stem cells from a donor, typically a brother or a sister, the procedure is known as an allogeneic stem cell transplant. An allogeneic stem cell transplant is also certainly done in myeloma, but I would stress that this should be done only in the context of clinical trials. Generally, transplants are appropriate for myeloma patients, and the appropriateness of this procedure is largely dependent on some of the other characteristics of patients, so that physicians need to look at things like kidney function, lung function, liver function, and heart function before a procedure such as this transplant is considered for patients with myeloma. So obviously, we're very excited about all of these FDA-approved drug combinations which have been made available for the treatment of myeloma. This expedited approval process has in part been largely due to your willingness to participate in clinical trials, and Dr. Wolf is going to touch on this in some detail after I'm done. In the past year, however, as I've mentioned earlier, the focus now has shifted rather than using these as single agents, but these in combination, so that one combination which is very effective in the treatment of myeloma includes the combination of bortezomib with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. As mentioned earlier, you get 100% response rate with this combination. And honestly, our goal here is to transform the chronicity which we're seeing with myeloma now, hopefully into a cure in the very near future. We've seen excellent efficacy and tolerability with these combinations. Novel single agents of great promise include a new proteasome inhibitor called carfilzomib, which has shown remarkable activity in treating patients with multiple myeloma, even after being previously treated with bortezomib. Another very exciting new immunomodulatory agent is pomalidomide. This is the newest IMiD. It's the next one after thalidomide and Revlimid, and in fact has shown very good activity in patients who failed after treatment with thalidomide and with lenalidomide. We're very excited about several classes of drugs which are currently in clinical trials. Several combination approaches are underway. For example, we have combined HDAC inhibitors such as panobinostat and vorinostat with bortezomib based on targeting different signaling pathways and seen a lot of activity when these drugs are combined. Other combinations which have come out of lab research are currently ongoing clinical trials. For example, we've combined RAD011, which is an mTOR inhibitor, with drug like the immunomodulatory lenalidomide based on proteomic data. Other drugs include CNTO-328. This is an anti-IL-6 antibody, which again in combination with bortezomib has shown a lot of activity. There are several new antibodies which are quite exciting and have shown very promising results to date. These antibodies include one being LY2127399, which is directed against a growth factor called BAF, and another one called elotuzumab, directed against CS1. These are both proteins produced either by the tumor microenvironment or by the tumor itself. And we have both of these drugs in clinical trials in combination with either lenalidomide and bortezomib, and they've shown very promising activity. Because of the rapid evolution in available therapies, I would encourage all patients to seek out clinical trials and communicate with their healthcare providers and see what is available at their centers and determine if that particular trial would be appropriate for them. Obviously, treating the underlying myeloma is going to help with a lot of the symptoms which I had mentioned to you earlier on during my discussion. But there are certain additional treatments which need to be carried out, and those specifically for bone disease, because bone disease occurs in about 80% of myeloma patients. Because bone disease can weaken bone and cause fractures, in addition to the anti-myeloma therapy, one strategy which should be used for all myeloma patients includes the use of bisphosphonates. The use of either pomidronate or zoledronic acid is recommended for the treatment of myeloma-related bone disease. These bone-strengthening agents have proven in randomized trials to decrease the incidence of pain, fractures, and need for radiation. In fact, most recently in a very large randomized trial in England, it was demonstrated that if patients received zoledronic acid, they actually had a survival advantage. Other local measures, sometimes for back pain, etc., can include procedures such as vertebral augmentation, including vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty, which can oftentimes help with painful compression fractures. In certain situations, we do tend to use radiation therapy and surgical fixation, but we like to minimize using such approaches. Excitingly, we have several new novel agents which are currently undergoing preclinical evaluation, and these drugs in the future are going to be very helpful because they not only will be targeting the myeloma cells, but in fact will help with bone healing as well. Given the complexity of both the symptoms and the available therapies for myeloma, I think it's extremely important and critically important to partner with your healthcare team and communicate all your symptoms and your concerns. This is going to allow your healthcare team to provide you with the best possible care. Obviously, participating in available trials will help not only inform all of us and improve outcomes for all patients now and also in the future. Thanks, Carolyn.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Rajay, for a very informative and also very hopeful and very promising presentation that I think was very helpful to everyone in the audience. And I know you'll get questions during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Wolf. Dr. Wolf is Professor of Medicine, Director Myeloma Program, Division of Hematology Oncology, Blood and Marrow Transplantation, University of California in San Francisco. And Dr. Wolf is going to address how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, practical tips for symptom and pain management, a very important area for all of you, communicating with your healthcare team and how important that is, and physical activity concerns and tips. So it's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Wolf.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. I apologize for my voice. I'm in the middle of a cold right now. I've been asked to comment a bit on how clinical trials can contribute to treatment options. Clearly, we've made significant progress in the treatment of myeloma since the 70s, when people would live only approximately a year and a half or 2 years after diagnosis. We are now seeing patients live a decade or more in some cases, and that's all because of new drugs that are being developed. These drugs have to go through clinical trial testing first, and before we know that they're effective. And we have a different phases of testing that I'd like to explain. When a drug is first developed in the laboratory, it is tested in myeloma containing mice. It may be tested in myeloma cell lines in test tubes, but it then has to be tested in humans, and this is what we would call phase one, when the drugs are first given to people. These are often people who have had many other therapies prior to this and may not be responding to any of them, so that they are willing to take a chance that this drug may be the drug that helps them. In phase one, we are looking for potential side effects that the drug may have in people. We also are trying to determine what the appropriate dose is, because we don't really know once it comes out of animals what the right dose would be. There's still a chance, even at that phase one level, that the drug may help a patient. Once we've established the appropriate dose and what the side effects may be, we establish the appropriate dose so that the side effects are not overwhelming. We do what we call phase two trials. In phase two trials, everybody gets the drug at a certain dose, and we attempt to ascertain how many patients actually respond to the drug at that dose. That's a very good point, not that it's not appropriate for patients to do phase one studies. It's very, very important. But at phase two, there is some hope that the drug is going to be working and that we're administering it at the right dose. Once it appears that the drug has activity in phase two testing, and that may be in patients who have had many other drugs prior to the phase two testing, we do what is called phase three testing. And this is often the kind of testing that allows the drug to be approved by the FDA. In this testing, we may add the drug to other drugs that work, or test it head-to-head with other drugs. So in phase three testing, this is a comparative test in which we may take a known combination such as bortezomib and dexamethasone and compare that to bortezomib, dexamethasone, and the new drug to see if it adds benefit. At any of these levels, patients can be benefited. Clearly, over the years, these remarkable drugs such as bortezomib and lenalidomide had to be tested in this way, and I have patients I've been following now for over a decade who, I have one patient in particular who was the first to get bortezomib on the West Coast and the first to get lenalidomide on the West Coast, and in each case received perhaps 5 years of control of his disease because of that. In addition, this kind of testing allows us to help other patients who come after so that we know that these drugs are active. Is there a downside to doing clinical trials? Well, possibly. When you get these drugs, we often don't know what the side effects might be, and we also don't know that they're going to work. But that's the case in almost all the drugs we use in cancer medicine. None of them are truly 100%, although Dr. Rajay mentioned that our combination of bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone has 100% response rates. It took us a while to get to that point in myeloma. That's very unusual in cancer therapies. Although we're doing well in myeloma, we really only have approximately five or six categories of drugs we can call on right now that are in any way effective. That would be the proteasome inhibitors, the IMIDs. Alkylators are old-time drugs that we've had since the 70s, cyclophosphamide or melphalan, otherwise known as phenylalanine mustard, steroids such as dexamethasone or prednisone, transplant, which is high-dose alkylator therapy, as Dr. Rajay mentioned, and another category of drug, anthracycline, such as adriamycin or Doxil. Beyond that, if a patient has had all of these therapies and none of them are working it's very, very appropriate to ask if clinical trials are available. Even earlier in the course of therapy, it might be appropriate to ask that because, again, our drugs are not 100%, and perhaps the addition of another drug at some earlier stage in the disease will make it more effective. I'll be happy to answer questions later regarding this. In terms of symptom and pain management, I think for myeloma patients, the most common problems are the pain that occurs with back pain or from vertebral compression fractures or rib pains from rib fractures. Dr. Rajay has mentioned the amazing advances of vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty, in which, at least in kyphoplasty, a catheter is inserted into the vertebral body in the spine, a balloon is expanded, and then methyl methacrylate, a type of super glue, is put in there to give the vertebral body support. Beyond that, obviously, we use pain medications, often narcotics. It's important to remember that just anti-inflammatory medicines, such as ibuprofen or Advil in this country, can be very helpful in addition to the pain medicine. But what's most important to remember is that, as it is with all symptoms in myeloma or other cancers, the earlier you catch it, the better, so that you must let your physician know early on that you're developing the pain, or, as we'll discuss, nausea or peripheral neuropathy. And prevention or getting on top of it and not letting it get too out of control is important, because once pain becomes very, very severe, it's harder to control than if you deal with it in a prospective way, that is, get enough medicine in early enough that it doesn't get out of control. A second problem in myeloma, perhaps not as much as some other cancer therapies, is nausea, and there are many, many drugs that we use for treating nausea. And again, treating before the therapy or before the nausea is very important. Peripheral neuropathy is a very common problem in myeloma, not just because the drugs can cause this numbness and tingling or pain in the feet or the fingertips and the hands, but because myeloma itself predisposes patients to have such symptoms. In this case, again, it is very, very important to let the physician or the nurse know early on when these symptoms are developing that it's a problem, because dose reduction or changing the schedule of the drug or the way in which we administer the drug may prevent the neuropathy. And as many of you on the line know, once the neuropathy is established, it's very, very hard to control it. And although many times it reverses, oftentimes it doesn't. So identifying it early and changing the drug administration pattern is very, very important. Once the peripheral neuropathy has been established, unfortunately, we have a whole list of drugs that we use, such as Neurontin or Lyrica or Cymbalta in this country, or anti-inflammatories again, or over-the-counter preparations such as alpha-lipoic acid and L-carnitine. But one drug doesn't work for everyone, so we have to experiment with these. Again, it's very important to identify it early and try to prevent it rather than be behind the eight ball and have to chase it with medications. Fatigue is a very important problem for our patients, not just because they may be anemic, because the disease may make them fatigued, but because some of the drugs make them fatigued. And exercise is very, very important for controlling fatigue. If you lie around in bed or sit in a chair all the time, the fatigue is going to get worse. Communicating with the healthcare team is very, very important. I recommend to all my patients that they keep their own files, they have all their own records, that they keep flow sheets of their laboratory data. It's very helpful for a doctor. Now, most doctors keep their own records, but if you're moving from doctor to doctor, it is much easier if you have all those records. It's important when you go for second opinions. It's important to understand the progress of your disease as well that way. You must keep meticulous list of your medications, the doses of the medicines, the schedule you're taking it on, and every time you come to see your physician, you should be able to produce that so that they can go over your medications. You should write out any questions you have for your physician ahead of time so that you don't sit there and say, there was something else I wanted to ask you, but I can't remember what it was. Write it out so that each of your questions gets answers during your visits. Almost all physicians have nurses they work with. They have mid-level people such as nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, practice nurses, and you should feel free to contact them if you can't reach your physician. In fact, often they're easier to reach. Finally, I need to emphasize physical activity. It is so important to get up and walk. There are certain things that you can't do because you have myeloma, such as heavy lifting or running, so that there's high impact. But certainly walking or walking on a treadmill is very, very important. It not only improves your fatigue, but it strengthens your bones and it'll strengthen your muscles and you'll get you through your therapy much easier. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Will, for a very comprehensive and informative presentation. There will be questions, I'm sure, for you during the Q&A. And thank you for just the range of information that you covered. And our next speaker is Rick Dickens, and Rick is an oncology social worker. He's our Blood Cancers Program Coordinator and Mind, Body, Spirit Project Coordinator at Cancer Care. And Rick is going to go over with you the free psychosocial support services that you can access from Cancer Care, as well as the importance of a support network. Rick?
Thank you, Carolyn, and I appreciate the educational expert advice of Drs. Rajay and Wolf. I'm going to use some of what they said to expand on that just within the context of social work services and cancer care in particular. What was already stated also, many people don't realize their oncology care is handled by a healthcare team, which includes an oncology nurse and social worker and other specialists. Physical therapists, chaplains, billing specialists, and such. And while each member specializes in a certain area, they are all working together to coordinate your care. When a doctor is not available, as Dr. Wolf said, you can often turn to the nurse or social worker who are aware of your treatment plan and can offer expert advice or guide you to someone who can. For multiple myeloma patients and families, there are numerous issues which can impact your lives, such as concerns about treatment, insurance, jobs, or who will help loved ones. Periods between treatment can create anxiety and uncertainty. When treatment becomes necessary, additional issues of self-esteem due to treatment side effects, as well as treatment-related fatigue, can impact normal activities of daily living. At some point, the whole process will become familiar to you, and you will develop what is often called a new normal. As Dr. Rajay said, that is why building relationships with your healthcare team are so important. For many, it is helpful to think of this relationship as a partnership or collaboration. Your oncology team are experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and your life. And for that reason, mutual respect can go a long way to foster the best supportive care. So here are some tips that can guide you along this process. Do your research. The Internet is a good place to start, but there are also helpful organizations such as Cancer Care that can guide you through this process. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer will go a long way toward giving you a sense of control and making you an active member in your treatment decisions. Take your time. With a new diagnosis, or even if you are dealing with a recurrence, you usually have some time before you must make medical decisions. Sometimes saying, "I need a day to think about this," can give you an opportunity to catch your breath and get feedback from loved ones and other resources. And finally, speak up. Don't be afraid to bring up any topic of concern to your healthcare team. Remember, your doctor and oncology team can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. Accepting that changes are normal during treatment can contribute toward nurturing your body and spirit. Rapid changes brought on by treatment can affect sexual and body functions and challenge most people's self-esteem, eliciting feelings of sadness, anger, fear, and frustration. And at the same time, what is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless, scared, and sad as well. During these times, it is often helpful to seek the help of a social worker or other healthcare professional from organizations, again, such as Cancer Care. Cancer Care has over 40 oncology social workers who inform people of resources and strategies for finding help. We also have a special door-to-door grant that Carolyn had mentioned for multiple myeloma patients, which assists with transportation expenses. And we also provide counseling, run regional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online support groups for patients and loved ones. Groups can provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation that you're not alone in what you feel. To many, Support groups and social supports go a long way in helping you to confront the difficult challenge of cancer. And daunting as those challenges are, with help, they are never impossible. Cancer care can be reached at 1-800-813-HOPE or www.cancercare.org. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, for just really eloquently describing the services of cancer care and also just the importance of having a network of support, people that you can turn to and services that you can access for help. And now we have time for questions. We have actually lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board. I'm also going to ask Mary to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. With so many of you on the call, if we do not get your question, please call Cancer Care at the the end of the call at 1-800-813-HOPE, and our staff are here and will address your questions. So that's really important. But we're going to try to take as many of your questions right now as possible. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Linda Kay.
Thank you for being there. When would you recommend that a PCR test be given, and how is the test done?
Well, thank you, Linda, for that question. Dr. Rajay, could you address that question?
So, Linda, you ask an important question. PCR test, I'm guessing you're looking for minimal residual disease, and this is typically done, after transplant. Now, this is not something which is kind of standard of care, Linda. We're doing it as a research tool right now. It's part of clinical trials so that when we are documenting response, you know, for myeloma, the good news is we have pretty uniform response criteria. We can go by most patients present with a protein and making sure that that protein is gone down to undetectable levels, as well as making sure that the number of plasma cells in your bone marrow have gone down is enough to document a remission. PCR is a molecular test to look for response. Again, just a research tool. So in general practice, not necessarily recommended right now.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Thanks for that excellent lead question, Linda. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Eric V. Eric, if your line is on mute, will you please unmute?
Yes. I'm calling regarding a mini allogenic transplant. When is that appropriate?
Well, thank you for that question. Eric, I'm going to ask Dr. Wolf to address that question in a general way. Dr. Wolf?
Thank you for the question. As Dr. Rajay mentioned, an allogeneic transplant is a transplant between a donor other than yourself to yourself. It is often done to try to provide an immunological control of the cancer. That is, we believe that in patients who have cancer that their own immune system is not controlling the cancer well enough. We attempt to get help from somebody else's immune system. The mini or reduced intensity transplant was developed in the last decade or so because so many patients actually died during the transplant in the 90s when we tried to do regular intensity allogeneic transplant. The mini transplant, although it sounds easy, is still a very risky procedure. It has a number of complications. It has a mortality rate that's significant, and a secondary complication called graft versus host disease, in which the donor cells actually, instead of just attacking the cancer, may attack the patient. And there's a mortality risk there and certainly a long-term morbidity risk that as patients are ill from this disease. Nevertheless, we believe that some patients, a few patients over the years, have been cured with this procedure. It's a very, very long discussion before deciding to do something like this, and as Dr. Rajay mentioned, should only be done on a clinical trial in a center that is experimenting with this because it's not standard of care at all.
And also, could you comment just on the expertise of the comprehensive center providing that care?
Yeah, there are very few centers that actually provide allogeneic transplant and have experience with mini allogeneic transplants, especially in myeloma. So I think we're talking about a limited number of centers. It's a there are some centers that have actually given up doing mini allogeneic transplants just because of the complications, although there are still a few doing it. But it's a difficult discussion, but it should be only undertaken in centers that have a lot of experience.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Wanda T.
Hi. I just recently had a stem cell transplant, and it was successful for the cancer in the blood, but I have a tumor in the pelvic area, and I have had 20 doses of radiation to it, and unsuccessfully it seems that nothing will shrink it. It's pushing in the nerves and my legs, and it's causing quite a bit of pain and discomfort. Could you tell me your suggestion on the next possible treatment for this tumor? It's inoperable. They say if they cut on it, I would either hemorrhage to death or it could paralyze me from the waist down. So it's really a very scary situation.
Well, Wanda, I'm going to ask Dr. Rajay to address your question, and then why don't you and I talk after the call as well? But I want Dr. Rajay to just address your question in a general way in terms of issues and concerns that you have and her suggestions. Dr. Rajay?
Yeah, so Wanda, I'm sorry about the situation, but again, I'm not going to address this very specifically. But in general, you know, sometimes we do get these extramedullary tumors like plasmacytomas, which it sounds like is going on here. Most plasmacytomas are very radioresponsive, and oftentimes radiation is what takes care of things. I think most of your symptoms sometimes are related to exactly where this tumor is anatomically, and unfortunately, if it comes in the way of nerves, that's what's causing symptoms. It is very possible that the tumor itself is not active, but it's the compression on the nerves which is causing problems. There are different approaches which people have tried, radiation being one of them, surgical fixation being another, but if it's in a difficult situation, you know, we at centers like ours, we do have interventional radiology where sometimes a little bit of medication like a steroid injection, et cetera, in those areas helps relieve some of the pressure on the nerves. But it's clearly a difficult situation, and we're seeing, more of this kind of emerge in the last few years where our bone marrow disease is pretty well controlled, but we are seeing extramedullary disease in the way of these plasmacytomas.
Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Mary W.
My question concerns the frequency and duration of bisphosphonates. I have read many places that the half-life goes anywhere from 7 to 11 years. So what is the necessity of continuing them so regularly when you have myeloma?
Okay, well, thank you. Dr. Wolf, could you address that?
There are so many questions that still remain in the use of bisphosphonates. I think that myeloma doctors do not disagree that, as we all agree on their benefit, especially early on after the diagnosis, the studies have shown that they're best used on a monthly basis. But once a patient achieves a complete response, for example, how long should they go on with bisphosphonates? We know that there are some downsides, whether it's kidney function or osteonecrosis of the jaw. Do we really have to continue every single month forever? These questions haven't been answered adequately in terms of studies. I think most physicians, I'd be interested in Dr. Rajay's opinion as well, tend to continue the monthly bisphosphonates for a year or so after a patient achieves a complete response, and then decreases the frequency to every 2 months, every 3 months, even twice a year, or stops altogether when patient's disease is well controlled. It's an area, unfortunately, that has not been addressed with adequate studies.
Thank you, Dr. Ajay. Did you want to add?
Absolutely. No, I would completely agree with Dr. Wolf, and you asked a very relevant and very valid question. And, you know, I think largely the concerns for continuing bisphosphonate therapy was the emergence of osteonecrosis of the jaw, and at least what the guidelines now tell you is continue it on a monthly basis for about 2 years, and then you can either stop or, depending on whether the patient has active disease, continue on a less frequent dosing interval. Again, no data. Having said that, we are doing a study where we're using biomarkers to help dictate how often bisphosphonates should be given, and this is, we're using a biomarker called N-telopeptide. N-telopeptide is a bone resorption marker, and based on this marker, at least we reported this at ASH last year, and hopefully we'll have the whole data reported, but we've been giving zoledronic acid based on N-telopeptide levels every 3 months to our patients, and at least to date we found that this is a safe way of giving it, and it does not impact on skeletal problems, so that you're not increasing skeletal-related events. But your point is absolutely well taken. You know, you don't necessarily need to continue on these bisphosphonates monthly forever.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay, our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Frances L.
I had stomach, very sensitive stomach before my stem cell transplant and before my chemotherapy. And now, you know, I still have the problem with heartburn, waking up in the morning. And a naturopath doctor has suggested that I use probiotic, some kind of probiotic powder to put it to the cereal. And yet I read somewhere it says that for people who have compromised immune system should not be taking probiotic. And yet my oncologist doesn't seem to have any problem with me taking probiotic. What is your view on that?
Well, Frances, thank you for that question, and I think that's a question that probably comes up a lot on our calls. I'm going to ask Dr. Wolf to address that, if he would, please.
Certainly we are concerned about secondary infections and introducing other bacteria. I personally have no problem with probiotics, especially in patients who are not under active therapy right now, who have not just had a bone marrow transplant, for example, who are not on high-dose dexamethasone or steroids. I really don't see that it would hurt. On the other hand, you have to ask if it's really helping your stomach problems. If it's not really helping, then there's no real reason to do it. I would also make sure that you're getting some kind of proton pump inhibitor antacid, something that can help with the acid that you may be experiencing.
And is this a common symptom with the treatment of multiple myeloma, or does it merit its own workup, and I'm going to use the word, a fancy word, differential diagnosis, in terms of figuring out what's going on, in terms of, so that Frances can get some relief from this?
Hard to know exactly what Frances's problem is due to. She said she had problems with her stomach prior to the myeloma and the therapy. This may just be exacerbating it. It's not the most common problem in myeloma. We do have patients with this problem. I would say that if it continues and if it's interfering with her life, it should be evaluated more intensely.
So, and I'm going to ask Rick to comment here, too, because we clearly have a number of the callers who are very proactive and actually asking good questions and really being information seekers. And Rick, I wonder if you'd comment in terms of your support group, where people are really reading about what, you know, what is out there and trying to help them make better decisions or more informed questions when they see their doctors. If you could comment on that, Rick.
Well, support groups can go a long way, definitely, Carolyn. What I would say is there are some simple mind-body techniques that can really help with chronic pain conditions. Learning certain breath techniques can calm the mind and the body. And oftentimes the literature does show it can help people tolerate some of these discomforts and such that they experience. Some groups, definitely, that I have run over the years do incorporate people who do yoga or meditation. I know for multiple myeloma patients, some of the mind-body techniques such as Tai Chi, Qigong, and yoga require some more body movement, which can be more difficult. But meditation, imagery, some of those techniques can be very helpful when I work with people who do have chronic pain problems. And, again, not necessarily to take the pain away, but there has been more and more research showing that people who do engage in simply prayer or belonging to a house of worship, some studies have shown that they're able to at least tolerate and the quality of life is much better. So I just open, you did mention a naturopath, and I would open that more to exploring perhaps some other techniques that might be helpful during these difficult times, Francis.
Thank you. And Dr. Rajay, would you want to add anything?
I completely agree with both Rick and Dr. Wolf, doing alternative approaches sometimes does help with some of these chronic issues. And things like acupressure, puncture, which Rick didn't mention, massage therapy, very helpful, not only for symptoms such as this, but things like neuropathy, which Dr. Wolf had mentioned earlier on, seems to be very helpful to some of our patients. So I would certainly seek those kind of alternative approaches. And I think most oncologists today have, you know, when we talk about diseases such as myeloma and making these diseases very chronic, you know, we are completely in tune with the fact that you are going to seek out complementary therapies. The thing I would stress, though, is, you know, there's a lot of herbal remedies out there. There's a lot of other stuff out there. Just make sure that you've spoken to your physicians, to your healthcare team, and really let them know what it is that you're on, because some of those may interfere with what you should be getting for your myeloma.
Thank you. Excellent questions and a wonderful dialogue amongst our speakers. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Bill H.
Yeah, this is Billy Holmes. I had multiple.
Hi, Billy. Good to have you on the call.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Mr. and Ms. Smith. But anyway, I had a problem with that. With me having multiple myeloma, I was hit over my head, and it caused me to be dizzy and stuff. And I go to my doctors, and they just said, let it go. You got to stay on it. I feel that with me having multiple myeloma and all the other things, I should have more looked into. Am I correct in assuming, or am I doing it, or should I just go ahead on and listen to what they say? That's what I need to know.
And you're being a very proactive consumer here. I'm going to ask Dr. Rajay to comment on this. You had a sort of head injury, and then you're feeling dizzy, and the question is what we're going to talk about, just generally what would be a recommended course to take. And I'm going to ask Dr. Rajay just to talk in general, and then, Bill, you can go back to your treating healthcare team and address that with them.
Sure. So, you know, dizziness and headaches are not usually common symptoms of myeloma itself, but certainly you've had, in this case, it was related to a head injury, and any head injury needs to be worked up. I'm sure you should absolutely go back to your healthcare providers and make sure that they've done the necessary testing. As far as myeloma is concerned, though, it's unlikely to be related to myeloma. Sometimes dizziness is seen in myeloma patients when they're extremely anemic. You can be lightheaded and dizzy. The other reason to get headaches and dizziness is when you have a very high tumor burden, so that you have very high protein levels in your bloodstream, making the blood thick and causing kind of cloudiness in the brain. But that is extremely rare, very, very rare with myeloma, so I wouldn't expect it to be related to myeloma specifically.
Excellent. Thank you. Excellent. And our next question?
Our next question comes from Robin H.
Hi. My disease has been pretty stable for the last 4 years, and I've been on Radia almost 5 years, and my physician wants to discontinue it now, even though I have severe osteoporosis, and I've just found out I had a 6% decrease in my bone density, and I've broken 8 bones in the last four years, and I'm only 51. What would you suggest after this if he wants to discontinue my Radia?
Okay, well, thank you, Robin, for that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Wolf to address your question in a general way, and then we'll ask you to take that information back to your treating healthcare team so he's going to just address it in a general way in terms of information about this. Dr. Wolf?
Yeah, thank you. This is, again, a very difficult question and a good question. When we've defined that the myeloma is under control, and that definition may be changing, but let us say for a moment that we can't measure the proteins, the bone marrow is normal. As we said earlier, how long do we continue bisphosphonates? And do we continue them on a monthly basis, or do we cut down the frequency? And as Dr. Rajay mentioned, we're doing studies to try to look at whether we can actually measure when we should be giving these bisphosphonates. I would suggest if the myeloma in general is under control for so many years that monthly bisphosphonates are not necessary, and that perhaps an approach that's more specific for just generalized osteoporosis that we see in the population, often older patients, often women who are postmenopausal, that perhaps we approach it in that fashion.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You have really just been outstanding. It's been a really amazing program, I have to say, quite remarkable. I want to thank all of you also who have asked questions, who've queued up and asked really such excellent questions. We know that you ask the questions to get an answer in terms of your own situation, but in asking your question, you end up helping everybody on the call. And I want to thank you all who have been listening as well. I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour education program and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So I want to first of all reassure you that although the program will be ending soon, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those continue, and they are endless to some extent. You can contact us at any time and access our services. The same is true for all the other organizations that are listed in your materials. I do just want to focus on Cancer Care because I don't want anyone to leave the call feeling that you are alone in having to cope with myeloma, cancer-related issues, or issues that your problems that you may be dealing with. You're now part of a community of support. Cancer Care has a staff of over 40 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a whole variety of services. We're here to provide individual support and counseling. We run all types of groups, both telephone groups and online groups. We also offer practical and financial assistance. We have lots of materials, fact sheets, and booklets. And, of course, we have this program that we offer, all these Connect workshops. And we also have the door-to-door multiple myeloma transportation assistance program to help you, a little more generous grant for all of you who may be having transportation financial issues in terms of just getting back and forth to your treatment. It's really important to be aware of that program and to access it and to contact us about that. Our Cancer Care's toll-free number is 1-800-813-HOPE, and our website is www.cancercare.org. So as we conclude the program, I want you to know that you're not alone, that you're part of our community here now, and you just have to call us. Let us know what we can do to help, and we will try to be as helpful to you as possible. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.